So the speakers in this series are charged with talking a little bit about their professional and personal journeys. Despite that charge, I'm hopeful that this night will actually be more about the mentors who have guided me through my own journey. And I'm also hopeful that this will help inspire some of you to think about education, educational research, and Indigenous communities and their experiences in different ways. So really, this night is about you. There will be a quiz at the end. Just kidding. I'm going to read quite a bit from my script and my notes, in part because I could talk for hours and hours about any one of these topics, and I know that a lot of you probably would not appreciate that. I've also become very used to co-presenting, often with some of the individuals highlighted tonight. And they're very good at helping me stay on track. So without them here, I need to stick to my notes. I'd like to begin with how academics often end their presentations. Acknowledgements. I'm not possibly able to name everybody who has contributed to my own journey and mentored and supported me throughout my career. In particular, I'd like to thank my past and present students, who are my greatest teachers. Everything I've achieved is because of what I've learned from and with students, mentors, and community members. Most importantly, I'd like to acknowledge that while yesterday was officially Indigenous Peoples Day here in Bozeman, every day is Indigenous Peoples Day, and every place where we gather is on Indigenous land. For example, many sovereign Indigenous nations have both traditional and contemporary claims to where we're meeting tonight, including the Apsalika, Piikani, Salish, Cheyenne, Shoshone, Nez Perce, and many others. While land acknowledgments are becoming more popular throughout academia, they are also frequently criticized for being superficial or disconnected from focal content. In my own learning, I often have to remind myself to take a purposeful look at the intersections between peoples, places, and perspectives. To understand where we are, we have to know where we're coming from. This is a very old photo that one of my cousins sent me just yesterday, actually, of my grandparents in north central Montana, outside of a very small town. So first, I'm going to share a little bit about theory and methodology. Yay! I'm sure there are lots of people who are excited about that. And the bulk of the presentation will hopefully focus on stories and examples to illustrate how the lessons I've learned have shaped my thinking, learning, and research. My journey as a scholar and learner has been greatly informed by community-based participatory research. I actually prefer community-centered participatory research. Community-centered research is complex and transformative in that it requires us to consider the community's unique peoples, places, knowledges, ways of knowing, and also how all of those aspects intersect when we make decisions about every aspect of the research process, from developing research questions to disseminating results. Community-centered participatory educational research is grounded in the belief that educational stakeholders have the expertise needed to address their community's unique challenges. Communities across the rural West, especially Indigenous communities, are incredibly resilient despite their geographic, economic, and political isolation. Native histories and experiences are often the most misrepresented in K-12 curricula and even in post-secondary education. Yet Indigenous communities continue to be excluded or marginalized when it comes to decision-making in many educational settings. This is especially problematic for a place like Montana, where Native students comprise about 12% of the K-12 student population, but over 95% of the teachers are white. So my colleagues in the Department of Education and I are often working to prepare teachers who themselves have very little understanding of the histories and experiences that are most relevant to their students. As Cherokee scholar Thomas King notes, the truth about stories is that's all we are. I hope this presentation highlights stories of possibility. It will not be about the challenges facing Indigenous communities. Those are very real stories, but they're not mine to share. The stories I'm highlighting tonight were all co-constructed between myself and Indigenous mentors. I'm forever grateful to those individuals for granting me permission to share them with you tonight. As a former high school teacher, current teacher educator, and educational researcher, I also know how powerful stories can be in terms of teaching. They aren't simply for entertainment. However, for learning and transformation to occur, we can't just sit passively. There must be work on the part of the listener. My development as an educator and researcher has been greatly influenced by First Nations scholar Joanne Archibald, who emphasizes the importance of dialogue, interactivity, and dynamism within the process of telling and hearing stories. To encourage this story work, Archibald urges us to learn from both the content and the practice. In my ideal world, I'd be co-presenting this talk, as you heard, with those who have helped me learn. I am still learning, and I hope I always will be. Therefore, as a scholar, especially as an educational researcher, I think about framing results from my research as lessons rather than findings as much as possible. We tried to tell you, if I had a dollar for every time somebody said that to me, I would probably be able to retire early. I can't provide a number of times in terms of how often this sentence has been said to me, by people in this room even. In a way, this phrase has been the trickster, like the coyote in my own professional career. Do you see in this, this image there, do you see the coyote right there? This coyote visited me just the other evening while I was working on this presentation. While I have long been learning about the importance of listening to students, community members, and mentors, and while I emphasize such listening in my scholarship as a methodologist, researcher, and educator, I don't always follow my own advice. Sometimes I'm tricked into not listening effectively enough. So to help guide my efforts and focus my efforts as a listener and a learner, I frequently look to 4 R's highlighted by leading Indigenous scholars. This framework also offers a way to organize the following stories. So the first R is relationality, not just in terms of relationships between people, but also between people and places, and between people and ideas. The second R is reciprocity, and this doesn't mean an equal exchange 100% between groups involved in the process. In terms of Indigenous scholarship and community-centered work, we should be thinking about ways that we can benefit the community first. The third R is responsibility, and within any work that's working to advance social justice, this hinges on the idea of creating change. And finally, respect. And that means respect not only for knowledges, but also ways of knowing about those knowledges. It's important to note that the stories and lessons I'm sharing tonight are not sequenced chronologically. As I think about these aspects within my own scholarship and learning, I find myself moving back and forth fluidly. That said, we have to start somewhere, and a good place to begin is by thinking about who we are. So this first story has been co-constructed over the past 7 years with one of the most important mentors and research partners in my life, Dr. Brad Hall. Brad was raised on the Blackfeet Nation, and until 2 days ago, he lived in Browning, where he worked as the institutional researcher at Blackfeet Community College. This past Sunday, he moved to Missoula, where he's just started as the tribal outreach specialist for that other institution. We're working this out in our relationship. Brad and I met at a state educators conference. I was in the audience during his presentation, and I was struck by the rigorous and innovative oral history research that he had his high school students doing and working with community members. So after the presentation, I asked Brad about the next steps for his students and how I could help. He explained that he wanted his students to be able to create short films to document the oral histories and share them with the community. Thus, the idea for the Digital Storywork Partnership was born. That project now involves community members from several Indigenous nations, from youth through elders, and is contributing to research, knowledge production, and education surrounding cultural histories, language revitalization, and wellness. Through our partnership, Brad and I have learned about teaching, research, ourselves, and our relationships. In particular, Brad has helped me think critically about who I am, where I come from, as a descendant of settlers in Blackfeet country. For many Indigenous peoples, who you are depends on your relationships. As Indigenous scholar Sibzalian notes, I am my grandmother's granddaughter. My grandmother, here she is in the picture holding the baby, that's my mom, was born and raised in a tiny town in north central Montana, 100 people today. I remember being fascinated to learn that my grandma really did ride her horse to school. As a horse crazy kid, I thought she must have had the perfect life. Several years ago, Brad and I were talking about my family's history as settlers, and Brad shared a story about his great-grandfather. Together, we did the math, and we realized that my grandma would have been about 3 years old when Brad's great-grandfather would have then been 10 years old when he was forced to board a train in the same small town where my grandma lived, which was bound for Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania. For those of you unfamiliar with the Indian boarding schools, these schools were designed to, as the founder of Carlisle himself said, kill the Indian and save the man. They were places of great loss of culture, identity, and life. Hundreds of children died as the result of malnutrition, disease, abuse, and homesickness at Carlisle. But Brad's great-grandfather was not one of them. He actually ran away, escaped the bounty hunters assigned to track down runaways, and returned to Blackfeet country. This story is something that Brad and I talk about often, and it is an example of the dynamism that is important to story work as these issues continue to shape our work. This map shows the traditional land base of the Blackfoot Confederacy, which includes multiple nations and spans the U.S.-Canadian border. Today, the Blackfeet Reservation is this relatively small, darker area up there on the Montana-Canada border. For many people, it may seem like the change from original territory to present-day reservations happened generations ago. However, the effects are lasting, and they continue to affect educational contexts both on and off reservations. For example, just a few days ago, the reservation border town high school my mother attended held a pep rally in preparation for homecoming against a reservation school. Several students at the predominantly white school put together a video that appears to portray an Indigenous woman in a red skirt being killed by white settlers. While it's difficult to know the intent, the use of the color red is particularly problematic, since that is the color being used by activists to raise attention to the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. This example is just one that demonstrates the ongoing tensions within reservation border towns. As a white researcher and an outsider in most of the communities where I'm collaborating, formal recognition of who I am is important both in terms of transparency to partners and in terms of keeping a check on analysis of data. It's also important in terms of encouraging others, scholars and educators, to see the possibilities in self-location work. For non-Indigenous peoples, this work can be and should be troubling, given the legacy of settler colonialism and its related white privilege, but it shouldn't be paralyzing. All three of these pieces emphasize the importance of self-location and awareness of relationality. The piece on the left, which was just published, is a practitioner-oriented synthesis of research, focusing on confronting the legacy of settler colonialism in social studies education, and in our own lives as educators and scholars. One of the takeaway messages from this article is the importance of recognizing and compensating Indigenous partners for their expertise, time, and energy that is needed to mentor non-Native teachers and researchers. The article at the bottom is one of several works co-authored with Brad. The study highlighted here analyzed the effectiveness of digital story work projects with tribal college and high school youth. It's a complex piece because it describes a multi-year case study of student-led research and learning as framed by Montana's Indian Education for All policy. So this is where educational research gets especially complicated. We are simultaneously studying student learning, student-led research, and policy. The piece on the right was my first major publication, which was co-authored with Dr. Angela Jaime while I was working on my doctorate at the University of Wyoming. One of the main reasons I chose to go to the University of Wyoming, and a main reason that I came to MSU, was to be within driving distance of the Wind River Reservation, so I could maintain relationships with the mentors who had shaped and continue to shape my work. Of course, driving distance, 6 hours one way, it's close enough in rural terms. This next story was constructed during my dissertation, which applied a participatory approach to narrative inquiry. One of my co-researchers was Eldora, or Dodi, White Eagle. Dodi and I met close to 20 years ago when I was teaching at a reservation border town school in Wyoming, and she was teaching at a school on the reservation. Over the next 2 decades, we worked together, encouraged each other through our doctoral studies, and became friends. While she's not able to be here in person, I'm fortunate that I'm able to see her twice this month. That might be a record, at least for the past 9 years. While she's not able to be here, I also am wearing a ribbon skirt that she gave me this summer, so that's very important to me. In addition to teaching social studies, Dodi has served as an assistant superintendent for curriculum and instruction and director for education for government agencies and nonprofits. She is currently the chief executive officer of the Northern Arapaho Tribe, a job that is unbelievably challenging given some of the current social, economic, and political issues facing the tribe. Despite Dodi's many personal triumphs and professional successes, she remains one of the most humble people I know. At the heart of everything she does are the questions, why do I do what I do, and how can I benefit my community? So why do I do what I do? Because of students like these. Just watch out for the one on the left in the red. If you could zoom in, you'd see that I'm in the blue, second from the left, and that I have a look of absolute terror on my face. In this photo, I'm afraid because one of my students, the one in red I warned you about, is teasing us that she's going to touch the electric bear fence and give us all a shock. By the way, this former student continues to show no fear today as an Indian relay rider, one of the top women who races, and they just started women's relays this past year, I believe, and she's been part of the inaugural group of those. To critically examine why I do what I do, you need to know what I do. Officially, I'm an associate professor in curriculum and instruction, which at MSU means I'm primarily focused on the preparation of K-12 teachers. You know what they say, those who can't do teach, those who really can't do, teach teachers. Of course, it's more complicated than that. I'm also an educational researcher, which means I engage in social and behavioral scientific research, humanities scholarship, and efforts to generate practical change through policy work. I didn't always want to be a teacher educator and educational researcher. When I first met Dodi, I thought I would be teaching at the high school level for my entire career. My high school students taught me more than any other group. And I hope my high school students go easy on me during the Q&A tonight. Dodie and my former students have taught me to embrace vulnerability. This means recognizing that I have privilege that results from my identity and background. But it also means recognizing how necessary it is for me to critically examine that privilege and the assumptions that are embedded within it in order to learn. Several years into my teaching career, I realized how lacking our mainstream materials were in terms of including Indigenous histories and stories, especially those of the area tribes. So I began working with an Eastern Shoshone knowledge carrier to integrate some of those narratives into my classroom. I invited the leader to come in and share some examples of creation stories. And then I asked my students to write a creation story about something important to them. I assumed that since I had guidance from a respected community member, that my instruction was appropriate. Years later, I shared this example with Dodie. I thought she would be impressed with my efforts, but instead she gave me a look of fear, kind of like the one I have on my face there. She told me that for Northern Arapaho people, sharing creation stories should only be done in certain contexts and by certain people. I was horrified to learn that by trying to be more culturally inclusive, I may have actually alienated or offended some of my students. But instead of hiding from that experience, Dodie encouraged me to think about it, to share it, particularly when I'm consulting with community members. Just because one person or one tribe holds a particular belief doesn't mean that all Indigenous peoples hold that same belief. This story also helps me remember the importance of thinking about reciprocity. As Sabzalian suggests, teachers, and I'd extend this to researchers, often make choices to make ourselves feel good instead of doing what is really best for community members and students. In fact, Sabzalian talks about white teachers, like me, sharing creation stories in superficial ways without having to venture into difficult topics such as sovereignty, knowledge commodification, or colonialism. Today, I encourage my students, readers, and myself to ask who benefits from this curriculum, from this instruction, this policy, this educational context. My dissertation offered an opportunity for me to apply participatory research and become more comfortable with my own discomfort. Similarly, several of my projects since then have made me vulnerable by explicitly turning tables on who is the learner and who is the teacher. For example, this piece was co-authored with Danny Morrison, who at the time was a pre-service teacher. We combined results from a couple of studies, including Danny's project focusing on the experiences of Indigenous social studies education majors at MSU, including negative experiences. As the leader of the social studies Broadfield program, it was physically and emotionally painful to learn about some of these experiences. But such learning is leading to change in my own classroom, in our programs, and across campus, and maybe even beyond. I'm still learning every day, and I'm thankful to people like Brad, Dodie, and Danny, who are so patient with me as I flail along. The third story is about more of the lessons I've learned from my students. I'm so fortunate to be able to consider Amanda LeClaire Diaz, not only a former student, but a co-author, co-presenter, co-researcher, colleague, and friend. I first met Amanda when she took one of my classes as a ninth grader. She was pretty quiet back then, was a great student, an aspiring writer. She's becoming more vocal today, particularly in terms of issues surrounding educational justice. Amanda was also a student and McNair scholar at the University of Wyoming when I was there, and I served as one of her mentors for the McNair program. She graciously agreed to be one of my dissertation co-researchers. During that time, I learned that all students who identified as Native in the high school where I worked were required to undergo English language learner testing. I remember Amanda being pulled out of my classroom as a junior, but I didn't really know why. Today, Amanda has a master's in English, and she's finishing her PhD at the University of Arizona. In a couple of weeks, she'll receive a national award for her leadership within multicultural education. This is an image of Lander, Wyoming, the reservation border town where I lived and worked for the first 8 years of my career. One of my committee members for my master's program, who identifies as Black, Irish, and Cherokee, and who spent a summer in Lander, once asked me why I'd want to live in what she calls the, quote, most racist community, end quote, she'd ever visited. Despite Lander's many challenges, I still believe reservation border towns have the potential to be really powerful contexts for learning and social change. Of all the lessons I've learned from Amanda, the most significant focuses on the many ways, the quiet ways and the loud ways, we can disrupt racism and enact change, even in these challenging contexts. At the high school, I was the coach of the speech and debate team, and I was thrilled when Amanda joined and decided to compete in drama and oratory. One of the drama pieces she chose was by a Native author. After one competition, Amanda and I talked through our frustration with the comments from one of the judges, which included a recommendation that she sound more Indian. After that, Amanda and I had many conversations about representation, resistance, and how to do something when a change is needed. I think about that dialogue and many others Amanda and I have had, particularly when I think about authenticity and responsibility. As a white teacher and scholar, it's easy for me to say, it's not my place to try to create change for Indigenous children. But as one of my other mentors, who unfortunately is no longer with us, explained, now that I know about the injustices faced by Indigenous students, I can't just do nothing. This sentiment echoes Maya Angelou's words, do the best you can until you know better. Then, when you know better, do better. As a teacher educator and educational researcher, I take the responsibility to create change very seriously, since the lives of children are literally at stake. The greatest risk I took professionally, and the hardest choice I made, was deciding to leave high school teaching and pursue my PhD. At that time, I'd taken on a leadership role as division chair of social studies and English language arts, and one of my goals was to expand opportunities for our students to encounter Indigenous histories and stories. When I approached our administrator about funding to buy these materials, I was told that curricular change could only be made if there was rigorous research to support it. I learned quickly that there was, and still is, very limited research focusing on the influence of Indigenous narratives in education, and even less research focusing on such materials in reservation border town communities. When I shared my frustration with a couple of leaders from the reservation, one said, well, I guess you need to do the research then. I had no idea how to do research. I'd struggled in my stats class as an undergrad, so I thought I was doomed. But I decided to look into what it would take to become an educational researcher, and here I am. Three pieces helped me frame my own thinking about responsibility. One, which isn't pictured up here, is a chapter co-authored with Amanda and a couple of other scholars. That piece focuses on case studies highlighting the need to rethink Indigenous representations in research and media. The second piece on the left was published earlier this year, and Dean Harmon referenced it in her opening. This piece was a long time coming. About 6 years ago, three different people, including one of the mentors I've introduced you to tonight, shared concerns about the policies used to admit non-resident students, or those students who live outside of the geographic boundaries of a school district. Specifically, they noted that the requirements for admission to reservation border town schools seemed to discriminate against Indigenous students. So I completed a policy analysis using critical discourse methodologies and found that border town schools do indeed use language that reinforces discrimination. The position statement on the lower left there, or lower right, was co-authored by a fantastic group of Indigenous and non-Indigenous scholars, including the current president of the National Council for Social Studies, who is with us tonight in the audience. And this piece urges responsible representations and attention to current events, movements, and sovereignty. It concludes with a call for relationships that ensure meaningful consultation with Indigenous communities. Such work should be sustained, multifaceted, and it should inform change. In other words, having an Indigenous partner sit at the table simply as a token advisor delegitimizes relationality. The final story I'll share tonight comes from Marty Conrad, who worked as an instructional coach in the Reservation Bordertown School District where I taught in Lander. We were the first two to complete a graduate certificate program in Indigenous education offered through the University of Wyoming. As a former social studies teacher, Marty was particularly interested in thinking about ways to change history books. Marty and I almost always got along really well, except when the topic was football. You see, I was born in Nebraska, and once a Husker, always a Husker. As you can see from the photo, Marty was born and raised in Oklahoma. That's all I'm going to say about that. While Native American Heritage Month draws attention to Indigenous experiences that are often otherwise excluded, it can also encourage marginalization. The best education infuses or centers Indigenous experiences throughout the entire year, instead of relegating them to a single day like Indigenous Peoples Day or a month like Native American Heritage Month. Midway through November, Native American Heritage Month, the year that I met Marty, he asked me, why is it that I'm popular only during Native American Heritage Month? He was half joking because he knew I knew the answer, that teachers, even those in reservation border towns, continue to see Indigenous peoples' histories and perspectives as marginal or something extra to add to the curriculum. The result of this is the tendency for Indigenous students to believe they are marginal. As one of my high school students asked, why should I go to class? It ain't gonna be my history. It's almost impossible to keep up with all of the misrepresentations in schools and universities. I'm not familiar with this particular resource, but the cover doesn't make me hopeful. The cover has quite a few popular stereotypical images, and the focus on art and myths raises red flags for me. Of course, Indigenous art can drive powerful learning opportunities. More on that in just a moment. But too often, K-12 curriculum includes superficial and disrespectful connections in terms of art. For example, students in many of today's classrooms are still asked to make dream catchers, masks, or war bonnets out of construction paper and brightly colored feathers bought at a hobby store. The use of the word myth in the subtitle is also problematic, as it suggests that Indigenous histories and worldviews are false or, as Indigenous scholar Eve Tuck argues, damage-centered. Fortunately, scholars, artists, teachers, and activists are confronting the centuries of misrepresentation. For example, Adam Sings in the Timber, who was here just a little over a week ago at MSU, uses photography to help viewers think about indigenizing colonized spaces. This photo, which appears with the Unsettling the Settler Within piece that just came out in Social Education, was taken in downtown Bozeman. As Adam suggests, this photo provides a powerful opportunity to think about the historical and continued presence of Indigenous peoples. Similarly, Subzalian's five orientations to support Indigenous studies can serve as a guide for both educators and scholars who are striving to respectfully generate change with Indigenous communities. For example, as we look at this image, we are invited to remember that this place, Bozeman, is on Indigenous lands, and that Indigenous peoples have a continued presence, even if that presence isn't overtly and consistently visible. That understanding may encourage us to think more about which perspectives have been excluded and how we can make them more visible. If we look deeper, this portrait offers opportunities to learn about sovereignty and other political issues, as well as the ways that formal and informal power structures might inform and transform learning about and with Indigenous communities. However, Sabzalian also cautions white teachers and researchers by explaining that, quote, "It's not my responsibility for you to learn," end quote. In other words, Sabzalian and Marty both emphasize the need for non-Indigenous allies to take up the responsibility to learn and to act. Although we should engage in meaningful and sustained consultation, we must be respectful, avoid overburdening Indigenous students, educators, and community members, and be sure we are actively doing our part. For example, Marty told me that teachers would sometimes invite him in to guide a lesson about Indigenous histories, and when he showed up, they would leave the room, or they would sit at their desk grading papers. They didn't see the lesson as an opportunity for their own learning, and they didn't value Marty's expertise. There are many ways non-Indigenous peoples can take up the responsibility for our own learning. For example, some upcoming opportunities. The Montana University System just released the Indian Education for All course, which is available to students, staff, faculty, and others. And you can go to that link and access those great resources. There's an opportunity to learn more from one of the leaders in Indigenous education here in the state of Montana on October 24th, the IEFA Professional Development Session, Native American Education, Promoting Strength-Based Community. That will be in the Procrastinator Theater. Ben Pease is going to be here also on October 24th. Here at the Museum of the Rockies, presenting on some of his amazing artwork. And finally, on November 12th, and this was just finalized today, the room and time frame, there will be an Indigenizing Your Syllabus workshop with a few people on the panel to help guide thinking about possibilities there. These three pieces all strive to address Marty's concern about misrepresentation of Indigenous peoples, histories, and experiences in curriculum and research. In addition to these articles, Marty and I and many other scholars and educators have helped develop curriculum and teaching guides to begin changing the narrative in K-12 schools and beyond, but we have a long ways to go. This image is one of my very first attempts and only attempts at beadwork. I spent 2 full days sitting at a long table with a few other teachers and community members from the Wind River Reservation. Within teaching, there's a mantra of, I do it, we do it, you do it. And the experts at the table followed that structure and allowed the rest of us the space to practice, struggle, and make mistakes. Partway through the second day, one of the grandmothers who had been coaching me and who was sitting way on the other side of the table glanced up briefly from her own beadwork above her glasses like this, looked at me and said, "You missed a bead." I want to end my talk tonight by noting that I've made many mistakes and I know I'll make many more. I'm fortunate to know so many people who are willing and able to hold me accountable and expect me to learn from my mistakes. For example, I still struggle to simply be present in the story and to listen, instead of trying to connect what the other person is sharing to something in my own life. Connection and story are really very important parts of the human experience, and they're vital for learning. But sometimes our eagerness to connect results in interruption or silencing of another person. Similarly, within academia, there is an expectation for self-promotion, competitiveness, independence, and efficiency. And sometimes those characteristics are in tension with community values and needs. Additional challenges can make it difficult to engage in community-centered research, education, and story work. Although it's driving distance by Montana and Wyoming standards, let's face it, 6 hours is a long way to go, especially if you have other teaching and research obligations. That said, 6 hours is nothing considering it takes years to develop relationships and research partnerships with rural and tribal communities. A final area of challenge I'd like to highlight is the tendency for community-centered research to be viewed as less rigorous than traditional research. In reality, community-centered researchers use a variety of traditional research tools. It's more of an orientation to research than a set methodology. For example, we use case studies and statistical analyses. I'm a bit biased, but it seems like community-centered research has more potential to be cutting edge than other approaches, especially when it starts to look at methodologies like story work. I wonder how much of the criticism is founded in an assumption that communities can't possibly be sources of expertise. And in terms of community-centered research within indigenous contexts, I also wonder how much of the criticism is an artifact of settler colonial thinking. As a teacher educator, one of my greatest tips for new teachers is to ask more questions, particularly if you as the teacher don't know the answer to a question asked by your student. Before we open things up for questions, I'd like to end with a few questions that continue to guide my own thinking about community-centered participatory research, story work, and partnerships with Indigenous communities. Who is learning and about what? Who decides what is worth learning, teaching, or researching? How will we demonstrate responsibility to ourselves, our communities, and others? What if we center Indigenous stories instead of just decentering other stories? How do we do that respectfully? Finally, a question from Brad Hall. How are you spending your energy? This is the essence of the title of this talk, we tried to tell you. If our energy is not going toward the four R's of relationality, reciprocity, responsibility, and respect, if our energy is not advancing what the community believes in and hopes for, then we are not hearing what people are trying to tell us. Such hearing takes real work, especially if the goal is to disrupt long-standing legacies of injustice, such as those often reinforced in K-12 schools. One of my first years as a teacher, I remember struggling to hear a prayer and introduction by an elder. In case you didn't notice, I'm pretty short. I'm actually standing on a little platform back here. I was standing at the back of a crowded room, and the speaker was going on, and I was able to only hear bits and pieces. I was really frustrated. I even thought about leaving the room at one point. Then I heard him say, "Chief Joseph didn't say, just kinda listen to me. He said, hear me, my chiefs." There is a reason for that. This really resonated with me. I started wondering what people had been trying to tell me if only I'd been able to hear. Thank you so much for coming this evening, and I'm looking forward to your questions. So there are several really good opportunities and programs here in the state of Montana even. One of those programs actually is a partnership between Blackfeet Community College and University of Montana Western. And they're doing place-based work developing teachers so that the teachers don't have to leave their home communities except for shorter periods of time. So one of the biggest challenges is that a lot of the people who are interested in teaching, who are Indigenous and from reservation communities, often serve in multiple roles in their home communities, and it's really hard for them to be able to leave for 4 years or sometimes 5 years to earn a teaching license. Our department actually just started this year a Master of Arts in Teaching program that's all online, and so for people who have a degree already but are interested in teaching licensure, that might be an option. And it, again, addresses that sort of challenge in terms of being in two places at once. So that's one step. Another key step would be to create a critical mass. And so that means providing more resources and support for students so that instead of having just a few students in a program, you have many students in a program. One of the students that Danny actually worked with in her study, he said, you know, I realize that this isn't going to end when I leave the program. I'm still going to have to deal with racism and microaggressions and misrepresentations as a teacher because most of my colleagues will be white, even if I'm teaching in a school on a reservation. And that was really alarming for him, I think, to realize, and exhausting. And so creating a critical mass so that the one Indigenous student in a class doesn't have to respond to those racist remarks or confusing remarks or whatever that come up in a class setting, that there are other people around to help support that student, that's another way to go. And MSU has actually made huge gains in terms of recruiting and retaining Indigenous students just over the past few years, hundreds of new Indigenous students. So I think we're on the way to developing that critical mass, but we have a long way to go.